Hey, shall we begin? So last time I mentioned the kind of organization of the whole middle section of the course, which is to look to these three major issues in architecture. And I mentioned that we'll be kind of relying back on that articulation of these issues in a general sense that was done by Vitruvius, this Roman architect, thousands of years ago. And Vitruvius thought that architecture could be divided into three sets of issues, which he called firmness, commodity, and delight. And I mentioned that we're going to be expanding those. Firmness will be all sorts of physical considerations. Commodity will be all sorts of human factors. And delight will be lots of different issues having to do with form. And we began last time this investigation of issues of form, that is the aesthetic side of architecture. And we're going to continue that today and for the next few lectures. So last time we were kind of thinking, what is this thing, beauty? Why would we want to have beauty? Okay, it's a status symbol, it's a sort of symbol of success. But in a more profound sense, it's just something we need as human beings. We need it as something to feed our soul. And then we talked about how you might accomplish that, looked at a number of buildings, why they sought out this beauty and how they accomplished that beauty through these 12 elements of form. And the Twitter card question last time was asking each of you individually, what of those 12 elements of form seems to be most resonant to you? What is it you respond to? It seems perfectly legitimate that different people would have different responses to different elements of form. So here is a selection of some of those answers. Someone says, symmetry is my favorite. Nature and biology are symmetrical, and it would be a travesty to disrespect our roots, but it would also be unbecoming to respect them too much. Symmetry must be respected and disrespected. Too much and too little are equally distasteful. Someone else said, my favorite element is balance. Unlike symmetry, you aren't restricted to producing an exact replica on both sides. Rather, you can create two unique forms that resonate with each other. Someone else says, to me, texture seems to speak the most. It is an element that combines both a sense of feel and a visual experience, so it seems to have more influence on my perception of buildings. Someone else says, I appreciate line the most. I think looking at the silhouette of the Sydney Opera House, a single great line, creates a really wonderful building. Somebody else says, the element of form that resonates most with me is shape. No matter the huge scale or the smallest scale, the shapes that are expressed by buildings or different eras are fascinating and attract the eye. Someone else says, I personally find rhythm to be the most important element to me. Because music is the only other way I have ever projected myself in an artistic way. I can relate rhythm to my artistic background in music. Someone else says, light is the most interesting element of form. Whatever the intention of the building may be, the spiritual uplift created by natural light is often the thing I notice first and remember the most. Someone else says, material is the most compelling element to me. Rooms with a lot of wood and fabric make me feel natural and warm, but metals and concrete tend to make me feel industrial and cold. Someone else says, the scale of the building is the one thing that you notice first. A large scale instantly indicates power, while a small scale provokes you to look more carefully. And finally, someone says, I think color resonates the best with me personally. Architecture is a form of art, and color can influence and or even change the feeling you have towards a building. Vibrant colors make buildings lively, while dull colors make you feel calm. If the colors are deep and dark, it can add to the richness of the building. The stained glass in a church can strongly affect the mood of the atmosphere. Really good, thoughtful answers there. And it's, you know, that was all 12. You know, somebody, there are multiples on all of those. For different people, we react differently to things that seem to be, you know, provocative and compelling to us in terms of these 12 elements of form. So this time, we're going to do a kind of corollary lecture to that one last time. Last time, we're looking at how do we sense a building just viscerally? How do we react to it in a very emotional, spiritual, intuitive way? And that's a super reasonable way to look at architecture. And certainly that's kind of what Rasmussen is about primarily. He's a sensualist. He's helping us understand how our senses respond to a building, but in a very gut reaction. Today we're going to look at form. We're going to look at the aesthetic side of a building. But how could the aesthetic side of the building actually speak maybe more to your head than to your gut? How is it that when you look at something, there is a message, there is and sometimes maybe a message that's more profound even than a written message. Words can be pretty explicit in describing a message, but maybe they don't have quite the same sticking power as an image that's in our head and gives us a message. And so today we're looking at architecture as a more intellectual, artistic experience, something in your head and in your mind, not just a visceral experience. And we're going to start by looking really at the same way we started last time, thinking in a two-dimensional visual experience, a two-dimensional aesthetic experience. How does this play out? And then expanding it to three dimensions in looking at buildings. So last time we looked at the slide on the left, which is Le Grand Odalisque by Jean-Auguste Ingres, and we talked about how beautiful this painting is, and God, it's an amazing, really beautiful painting. And we talked about the fact that it's got this balance, the drape versus the pose of the female form. We talked about the texture. We talked about the incredible light, how it shines on her body, and the contrast of the dark in the back and this luminous skin on her body. We talked about color. We talked about the shape of these peacock feathers, the same rounded shape in various parts of her physiognomy, her eye, her breast, her heel. You know, we can understand why this is such an incredibly elegant and beautiful painting. Now, I'm afraid I'm going to burst your bubble a little bit here. Le Grand Odalisque was a painting of a woman who had been taken into slavery. What an odalisque was in the Ottoman Empire was when the Ottomans went out and they conquered another land, they would take the very most beautiful women and they would capture them and take them back to Istanbul. And the emperor would give these women as sexual slaves to his generals or his high-ranking officials in his government. So when they would conquer an area, they would take all the most beautiful women, and then they would make them sexual slaves to these Ottomans in Istanbul. And in fact, in the palace in Istanbul, there's a whole precinct of the palace that was just the place where all these sexual slaves were kept. So that's what an odalisque is. That's what the word is meant to describe. So we know that this woman, although kind of glamorous looking there, was someone who had been whisked away from her family and her culture, and she had been made a sexual slave to some high-ranking official in the Ottoman Empire. But when we look at that painting, we're not really supposed to think about that. We're supposed to think about how beautiful, beautiful this woman is. The slide on the right was done 50 years later. It was done by a painter named Edward Manet. Edward Manet was a revolutionary painter, one of the founders of Impressionist art. And in Paris at the time, there were these great salons where if you were an artist, you submitted your painting to the salon. And the salon had a bunch of judges. They were kind of old fart, well-established artists. And they would choose the best of these paintings and they would hang them in the salon. And then the fat cat purchasers in upper crust French society would then look at those paintings and they would select them and they would, you know, pay big bucks for them. And that's how you got to be a successful artist, was you got your work exhibited in the salon and then, you know, the fat cats bought it. Edward Manet hated that system, and he was an incredibly, incredibly skilled painter, but he felt like art should do more than just be decorative, just be something you appreciate with your senses. So he painted this painting on the right and submitted it to the salon, and it was a complete revolution. I mean, it was so controversial, because here was a guy who clearly had the stature to be accepted to the salon. He painted really beautiful paintings, but wait, what the hell is this that he's submitting to the salon? And in fact, it's a painting with a very strong message to your head, not just to your gut, but to your head. So we see clearly a reference back to Le Grand Odalisque. That would have been considered, you know, 50 years after its painting, Ang is dead. He's a very revered artist. This is the epitome of what great art is. 50 years later, Edward Manet comes along and he paints a painting that clearly is a reference back to the Odalisque. Even what he calls it, Olympia, is a kind of play on the word Odalisque. And it's a beautiful painting. Edward Manet made beautiful paintings. And we can analyze it in exactly the same way we looked at Le Grand Odalisque. It's got beautiful balance. Now, instead of the drape on one side, we have the servant who's bringing the flowers. It's balancing the torso of the woman. The light is beautiful, and in much the same way, the light is beautiful in Le Grand Odalisque. This one's dark in the background, and then everything in the foreground is lit and kind of pops out from the canvas. The colors, again, really similar kinds of colors. These rich blues and ochres and reds. Very harmonious, beautiful, beautiful color palette. Line is fantastic, just as these smooth, sinuous lines were there in the body of Le Grand Odalisque. Here he even highlights the kind of edges of her body, and you see this very strong line through the whole painting. I mean, it's a beautiful painting. But it also is meant to say something about women, to say something about sexuality, to say something about attitudes toward men and women and their relationship in contemporary Paris society. So what we see here is something that would have been very familiar to a Parisian, especially an upper-class Parisian. In upper-class Parisian society, the men would frequently have kept a mistress. So they had their wife and their family and their children, but they also would have a little apartment, and they would keep a mistress there, and they would visit her and have sex. And that was just a kind of common thing for an upper-class male to do. And that's clearly what's happening here. We have her servant has gone down, her, the guy who pays her rent and comes and has sex with her periodically. He would have come downstairs. He's brought flowers. He's a gentleman, right? He brings flowers. He gives them to the servant. The servant brings them upstairs and gives them to this woman. Okay, it's time for, you know, Joe to get his rocks off, right? So that's kind of what's happening here. pretty clearly. People in Paris would have understood that. But he's saying, you know what you're doing, you respectable upper class men? It's not that different from what they were doing back then. And this woman is not that different than that sexual slave that was abused and that we'd look at now and say, well, that was a bad situation. But wait, what are we doing in a Parisian society? We're kind of duplicating that. And just by now the pose of the woman, she's not so demure, not turning over her shoulder and hiding her breast. Instead, she's just kind of facing you, a little more cold. And the look on her face, very beat down, not happy, not charming and beautiful like in La Grande Odalisque. So what Manet is trying to do here is to make you not only see this and feel this as a visual image, but also use it to provoke a thought in your head. What do you think about this? And I'm making the argument. I mean, he could have written an essay in the newspaper, right? Or maybe editorial. God damn it, you hypocrite, fat cat guys who come to the salon and buy my paintings. I know what you're doing. I know you've got that respectable wife and those respectable kids, but you're screwing around with, you know, this woman who basically you're buying her. And there's something really stupid about that. And he could have written that in an editorial. But instead, he makes a visual image that sears itself on your brain and that makes you maybe understand that issue or that point much more strongly. I'm saying that form has, visual things have the power to communicate some message, maybe even in some cases in a more potent way than words. A second painting, also by Edward Manet. We looked last time at Stuck by Nayland by John Constable, and it's a landscape painting, another great tradition, you know, portraiture, landscape painting. And the landscape painting is, as we said, very beautiful, and we looked at balance, and we looked at light, and we looked at texture, other things there. You could analyze this painting by Edward Manet in exactly the same way. It's got beautiful balance. See the torso of the man, the torso of the woman, the trees on either side. It's got gorgeous light, and really very much like the light here that I described, you couldn't see how the woodland path goes back there, and you see the dappled light. Well, this kind of goes back there, and you see the light back here as well. Wonderful texture of the trees and the grass, everything around here. It's a beautiful painting. But it also is meant to take another step. And this one is, oh my God, there are just layers and layers of message and meaning in this painting. So one thing is, again, we see very upper-class males, and we know that, by the way, they're dressed. They are dressed to the nines. These are rich men. And they're in a place Parisians would have understood to be the Bois de Boulogne. Bois de Boulogne was a big new park that had been built on the outskirts of the city in the late 19th century. And the Bois de Boulogne was a place that you went on Saturday or Sunday. You would get all dressed up in your best clothes, like these dudes are, and you would get in your fancy carriage with your beautiful horses, and you would get your wife and your children, and you would ride in your open carriage in the Bois de Boulogne, and people would see you. It was a see and be seen place for wealthy Parisians. And then you would stop when you go out to the Bois de Boulogne, and you would have a lovely picnic lunch that had been prepared for you by your servants, and you would spread the blanket, and you would have this very stylish luncheon on the grass. That was the thing to do on a weekend in Paris, luncheon on the grass in the Bois de Boulogne. So he names the painting Luncheon on the Grass, and so we're expecting, you know, these fat cats to be there with their wife and the cat. Oh, wait, that's not their wife and their kids. What are they doing in the Bois de Boulogne with their mistresses? And why is the luncheon all disheveled here? What's been going on in the Bois de Boulogne? And what he's doing is he's juxtaposing two completely different parts of Parisian life. One is the lovely family-oriented day in the park and luncheon on the grass, and these guys who are damn hypocrites and in secret have all these, mistresses on the side. So here, whoa, what are these dudes doing in the water Bologna with their naked mistresses? Oh, wow, that's not supposed to go together. So very powerful image of that. And then on top of that, he layers onto this a very famous engraving by the Renaissance artist Raphael. There was an engraving, and in that engraving, it showed a scene from Roman mythology. Now, in painting, there were rules at the time here in Paris. You could paint naked people, but they had to be gods. So, like if you painted Mars or Zeus or Neptune or Aphrodite, no problem. Stark naked, not a problem. But if you painted contemporary people like Joe on the street, yep, no naked. You can't, not naked. No, that's pornography. But if it's the gods, they can be naked. If it's dudes every day on the street, that's pornography. So Monet is like, what? That's hypocritical. I mean, everybody's got bodies. Why are we so weird about contemporary bodies? Yeah. So the question is, would you call this anti-romanticism? I wouldn't. This is not romanticism as an era in art. And it is rebellious against the period of romanticism. I would say the Grand Odalisque, that it's romanticizing the situation. Yes, this is doing exactly the opposite. So he's thinking about this hypocrisy of painting the gods naked, but you can't paint contemporary human beings naked. So wait, we do have this woman stark naked. But wait, we know this engraving by Raphael, where he's painting this scene of the gods, and in that the gods are naked, and in this scene the pose of the people is exactly the same as in this famous engraving by Raphael. So that woman is in exactly the same pose as the figure in Raphael's painting, and so why that exact same pose can be naked, and we revere it as great art if it's the gods, but here's this contemporary woman, and that's pornographic. So he's making the point, what stupid hypocrisy we have in the art world today. Not only that, but that painting by Raphael was a scene of the gods, and it happened to be of a young guy in Troy, in Greece, named Paris. His name was Paris. And Paris had abducted Helen of Troy, had fallen in love with her and whisked her away, stolen her from her parents. And he did that with the help of Aphrodite. So in this scene that Raphael is depicting, it is a trial where this dude is being tried for abducting this young girl from her family. And so it's the people in it are like Paris, this young guy, and Helen, and Aphrodite, and a judge. And they're in exactly this pose, precisely this pose, that all four figures are in the pose just like that. And everyone would know, okay, he's talking about this paint, this engraving, and you know what the engraving was called? It was called The Judgment of Paris. So it's this young guy, Paris, on trial. It's The Judgment of Paris. But he's saying, God damn it, this is the judgment of Paris, the city. What's wrong with us? What's screwy about us? What are we doing? Why are we such hypocrites? So he is giving you a visual image that is so complex. It is all about this reference to another engraving by Raphael. It's all about an issue of nudity and our human bodies and what's pornography and what's art. It's all about the hypocrisy of guys and their families and the women and the water Bologna and luncheon on the grass. All of this content for our head is buried in this one visual image. An incredible, incredible density of message in an image, and really revolutionary at the time in Paris. This made a huge controversy over the role of art, over the whole notion of salons, over the whole idea. I mean, this opened up art in a completely different way, that it could really be about social commentary. And that's what Edouard Manet added. Now, I would say the same thing happens in architecture, that there are messages embedded in the form that are meant to talk to our head, messages about social attitudes, messages about religion, messages about everything in a culture. And it's not just that that form is there to be pretty, that form is there to carry these messages. And I'm going to make the argument today that there are three things, and there are a zillion kinds of messages, but we'll talk about three today. The ability of architecture to talk about order. And I'm talking about in our lives. What is life about? Is life about clarity and analysis and logic and rigor and order and everything in its right place? And are we as human beings really about that kind of order? Or on the other hand, is architecture telling us that life is not like that? It's not simple. It's extremely complex. There are contradictions, there are ambiguities, there are difficulties. It's never able to be resolved. These are completely different life views, order versus complexity. A third thing we're going to look at is the ability of architecture to challenge our intellect in terms of looking at technique or technology. What is the role of technology? How prominent is it in our culture? How much should it lead versus other kinds of issues in our culture? So we're going to be looking at architecture talking about order, talking about complexity, and talking about technology or technique. And we're going to be looking at each of these issues in terms of two eras. The first era is the Renaissance. And we talked about last time how incredible medieval times were in terms of their search for sensual beauty. They maybe they understood it better than we do today, that notion of hyacinths feeding your soul, the idea that, you know, something very beautiful just nurtures you in this powerful emotional way. Well, right after medieval times came the Renaissance. And in the Renaissance, medieval times were a little bit about mysteries, about things we can't control, about things we can't understand. It was a difficult time. Sometimes it's called the Dark Ages, even. Along came the Renaissance, and there was an enlightening idea. Okay, wait, we're human beings, we're smart, we can control the world, we can take care of things. We've got science, we've got philosophy, we've got, you know, these disciplines that let us explain and understand and take control of the world and exert some kind of order there. So the change from medieval to Renaissance was a change of philosophy about what is life about, what is our role as human beings on Earth. And we can see that in the architecture beginning to say something about those issues. So we'll be looking at buildings in the Renaissance, and then as the Renaissance matures into a kind of, other kind of reaction to that, which is Baroque. And then we will also be looking at the modern era, the 20th century, which again was all about making things logical, making things analytical, making things engineered and correct and proper. And then we'll be looking a little bit as in a slightly postmodern era, which is a little bit of a reaction to maybe everything's not quite as buttoned down as it might seem. So let's dig in. So the first issue we're going to deal with is this notion of order. And as I said, very prominent in the Renaissance. This is the work of a high Renaissance architect, Andrea Palladio, in Italy. In the Renaissance, there was this kind of resurgence of interest in things that had been in the Greek and the Roman cultures, things like mathematics and science and philosophy, and this idea of using your head and being logical and analytical about things. Huge advances in things like mathematics. And mathematics were seen to be, that's the ultimate. That's what human beings are put on earth to do, to use our minds, to use our brains, and to do things in a mathematical, analytical way. So there were four what were called mathematical arts, and they were arithmetic, which was dealing with numbers, geometry, dealing with spatial elements, astronomy, which is dealing with the motion of objects in space, the mathematical relationship of those objects in space, and interestingly enough, music. They had just begun to understand that harmonics had mathematical basis. And so music got moved into the mathematical arts. So we've got arithmetic and geometry and astronomy and music, and those were hot stuff. They were the thing that people were looking at because we could see the mathematical basis. And then there were other things you did with your hands, and those were called the liberal arts, not what we would call liberal arts, but they were things like painting and sculpture. You didn't do them with your brain, you did them with your hands, because they involve liberal arts. But Palladio was one of those guys who said, no, architecture is a mathematical art. It has this logic and rigor and order and clarity, and it has a mathematical basis, and therefore it belongs at the sort of very top of what we see as mankind's ability to deal with intellectual things. So these are a couple of buildings by Andrea Palladio. On the left is the Villa Barbaro in Masser in sort of northern Italy. This one is all about telling you the world is orderly. We can straighten out the world. We can put it in order. And what he's done is he's taken this villa, which accommodates not only the family and very wealthy family, so a place to entertain their friends, dancing and dining and, great important public rooms, which are in that pavilion. And then the family's area, which is their bedrooms and their private quarters and their little living rooms in that area. But also this is a villa in the country, so they've got stock and they've got carriages and they've got servants, and so all of that goes over in this wing over here. But all of that, those are very diverse functions, but they're all kind of lumped together in this very clear, orderly device. Perfectly symmetrical, and you get the sense these people have their shit together, don't they? I mean, this really simple, clear diagram of their life sitting there. So that was in the countryside. In the city, in the slide on the right, we have the Palazzo Ceracati. But again, the same notion. Very orderly, completely symmetrical, separations of each bay, same size, same size, same size. Interlude, same size, same size, same size, same size. A very, very clear, orderly composition. Now, there are two things that were in pretty much every one of Andrea Palladio's buildings. You get dominant symmetry, that's huge, and you get this very, very systematized floor plan, something that is not accident. Everything is very carefully orchestrated into this floor plan. Maybe the ultimate Andrea Palladio book building is the Villa Rotunda. Now, in Rasmussen, he also talks about Palladio's work, so you should look at the way he talks about it in terms of really pretty much some of the same issues and the way we're talking about it today. So now, in Palladio's terms, he would try to find a way to organize that plan so that everything is just in exactly the spot it's supposed to be. I want to read a little quote from Palladio. He said, "The large rooms ought to be related to the middle ones, and these to the small, so that one part of the building may correspond with the other, so that the whole body of the edifice may have in itself complete harmony. Wanted harmony. That's really what human beings are about, is harmony, order. And so he's trying to make all of the rooms harmonious with each other. And his notion was nothing should be able to be added or nothing should be able to be taken away without completely violating the whole thing. It should be this perfect mathematical puzzle where everything is in its place. So he relates the whole thing to the cosmos, to astronomy, by making it line up with the cardinal points, north, south, east, west. So it's lined up with the cosmos there. It sits on the top of a hill. It faces four different directions, north, south, east, west, and each of those faces is identical. So it not only has symmetry, it has bilateral symmetry, two axes, and completely symmetrical about both of those axes as it sits on top of that hill. All four sides, exactly the same. This sort of sense of inevitability. How else could it be? Of course, it's perfect. In the center of all of that is this great rotunda, this dome. And that, of course, centers you in the cosmos, the sort of dome of the sky, the circular form of the globe. Here, that's reiterated here. Here I am, this rich guy with my big, beautiful villa, and everything places me harmonious with the cosmos and with the world and here in the center of my home. And these long axes, as you can see there, then leading your eye out to the landscape, due north, due south, due east, due west. Now, incredible, incredible plan of this thing. So this is a square, perfect geometric clarity. Inside that is another square right here. Inside that square is a circle. And you see the kind of relationship of circle and square. In addition, each of the four corners is a square, a square, a square, and a square. And that square is the same as this square. He was trying to take this notion of proportion and of mathematics and of numbers, and he takes it farther than just what your eye can perceive. It's embedded deep, deep in the DNA of the building, and it's done in numbers. So, for example, you see all those little numbers. Maybe you can read them, maybe you can't. But the width of this room is 15. The length of that room is 15. If you add, and then the width, the small dimension of that room, is 11. 15 plus 11 equals 26, and the length of the big room is 26. So 15, 15, 15 and 11, 26, all of those numbers working together. 2 times 15 is 30, which is the diameter of the circle. Also, the little corridor here is 6 feet. Double that is 12 feet, which is the width of the porch. All of the numbers, all of the rooms, everything is meant to interlock in perfect harmony and create this order. Now, part of this is totally in your head. It's sort of like you have to know the code, just like we had to kind of know the code in Luncheon on the Grass. But it also is something that immediately can be perceived. What is this culture about? It's about order. We're in control of things. We're tied right into the cosmos. We are dealing with mathematical verities. We're in harmony with mathematical verities. We are powerful, we're strong, we're confident, and that's what Renaissance culture was all about, and that's what the Villa Rotunda says. Very much the same kind of messages in the mid-20th century. And again, a culture that was very, very interested in everything being in its place, very hierarchical, very orderly. This is corporate America. This is follow the rules time. This is a dormitory at a Seven Sisters school. So there were the Ivy Leagues in the Northeast, and then they were all male at the time. And then there were the Seven Sisters schools, which were the counterparts to the Ivies. And this is one of those Seven Sister Schools, Bryn Mawr, just outside Philadelphia. This is a kind of Gothic campus. The buildings don't look like this. This one is very, very different from what had been done before. Lucan analyzes the program here, very analytical. And he says that, well, there are three major things that happen in a public sense in a girls' dormitory. And this would have been all girls, and no guys are allowed upstairs. So all the guys can only come into a kind of visiting room right here in the center. So there were three major public areas. One is that visiting room where you could bring your date or your family, and that was a public function. Then there was the dining room where all of the girls would eat. And then there was a living room where all of the girls had sort of parties and social life. So there are those three major spaces there in the center. And then around each of those are less public functions, like the corridor that everyone is meant to share. And then next to the corridor are the shared functions like the bathrooms in here. And then on the outside are the most private functions. So it'd be public, semi-public, private. Again, order, clarity, rigorous, well-planned life, everything in its place, order. So those would have been repeated three times here. And we get the big public spaces in the center. They have huge skylights. The skylights are on each corner there, all identical in all three pods. And you enter the central one. Everything's symmetrical. It's an expression of that perfect clarity. And then you have all of the articulation of that, the columns and the beams, the slabs, the everything sort of in a very repetitive, orderly fashion. Now, I'm arguing a bit here that these messages have an impact on people, that when you live in a place that has that kind of order, it starts making your head a little more orderly. You start thinking in a little more rigorous way. And that actually was the intention here. So the Seven Sisters schools had been women's colleges for smart women, really smart women, but the smart women were probably going to get married to a smart guy, and he was going to be the breadwinner, and they were going to be a housewife. That was kind of what the Seven Sisters thing was about. Any of you who saw Mad Men, the whole series, you know, those women went to Bryn Mawr, you know, but they didn't, you know, then they were a housewife and had two little kids. So that's what education had been about. But by the 1960s, the women who were running Bryn Mawr are saying, no, that's not the future. We're changing that. And if we're going to change that, one way to do that is to make it really clear in our buildings and in the environment that we're just as analytical, just as orderly, just as in control, just as powerful as the guys are. So we make a dorm that is all about order and all about analytical, clear thinking. And in fact, although Lucan is the architect, the name architect on this, one of the people working in his office very, very prominently on this building is a woman named Ann Ting. And Ann Ting was all over this issue. She was an unusual professional woman in a field that had no women much at the time. And she's saying, no, these Bryn Mawr women need a dormitory that conveys that sense of analytical, clear, orderly, those kinds of things. So did that make any difference? I just want to show one little detail here. So when I was visiting the building, it was in the winter time. It was still when it was all women. Now Bryn Mawr is co-ed. But this would have been back when it was still all women. And so one thing you learn if you go to school in the Northeast, I went to school there, and you realize that you do not need a fridge. So in Texas, you might want to have a little fridge in your dorm room to keep a Coke or something like that, keep it cold. Completely unnecessary in the Northeast, because you go to school in the cold part of the year. And if you want to chill your Coke, you just put it on the windowsill. You open your window, put your Coke out there, shut the window. Hour later, get your Coke, it's cold. So it's just automatic. And so these women at Bryn Mawr have figured that out, and you see their Cokes sitting on the sill out there. But I want you to look at exactly where the Cokes are. Perfectly symmetrical arrangement. Exactly symmetrical. Is there a way that, you know, we shape our buildings, thereafter our buildings shape us, that you inject that kind of orderly thinking, and yes, you become orderly thinking. But you know, a huge departure from what they had done on the Bryn Mawr campus, and a very strong kind of message in the building. It's all the way through the building. This is the living room. Now we're not talking about floral prints, soft, pretty. No. Strong, clear, diagrammatic, analytical, orderly. It's in the rooms inside. It's in the ceilings with those, that grid of squares, the great axes that connect these rooms together, the way the light comes in at the corners in a very orderly way. It says something about the kind of life you would want to live as a college student, maybe entering a new era for women in the 1960s. Okay, that's this notion of order. Architecture is very capable of dealing with order and communicating messages about order. Second issue I said we'd talk about is complexity. Now, maybe at a certain point, like you look at Palladio and you look at that villa out in the countryside and you say, wait, the place where the bedrooms are looks just exactly like the place where the horses live. There's something kind of crazy about that. That's a kind of fake order. That's a imposed order. Maybe, in fact, the world is more complex than that. Couldn't we really talk about, in a very intellectual and rational way, talk about the complexity of the world? And maybe, in fact, by the time we got to Baroque period in Italy, it's not, you know, everything's not that clear. The world is not that clear. Maybe we need to talk in an intellectual way about the complexity of the world and not just the order of the world. So in the 17th century, we have this really amazing architect practicing in Rome, Francesco Borromini. Francesco Borromini thought everything through. He overthought everything. He was a tortured man. He was extremely intellectual, very, very smart, analyzed, thought about everything. But his conclusion was not that the whole world is tidy and I can figure it all out, but that the world is kind of overwhelming. And I'm not sure. You know, I can think this through, I can think that through, but they seem contradictory sometimes. So he gets the commission to do this church in Rome, San Carlo. It's on a very, very important site. So it's at the intersection of two major streets in Rome. Remember in an earlier lecture I talked about at a certain point in the Renaissance, they had cut these major streets through Rome. It's medieval, twisty, windy streets. But in order to make it the holy city, they cut straight streets between the great churches so that you looked down the street and you saw the church. You looked down the street, you saw the church. So this is what had just happened in Rome. And these two straight streets had been cut through. And this is at the intersection of those two straight streets. The street we're looking at right here, at that end of it is the Roman Forum. It goes zoom straight and it goes to Porta Pia, which is one of the great gates in the old walls of the city. That the actual gate itself, Porta Pia, is by Michelangelo, and it's in Rasmussen's book. It's used as an example. So that was one of the streets. The other street in the other direction goes from Santa Maria Maggiore, also discussed in Rasmussen's book, from Santa Maria Maggiore down all the way here past the Spanish steps to the Piazza del Popolo, where there's twin churches down there. So at the intersection of these two streets, they opened it up a little bit because it was such an important intersection. They cut the corners off and they put four fountains there. And the four fountains were about the four seasons, you know, spring, summer, fall, and winter. And then they called this little piazzetta, not quite as big as a piazza, but the little piazzetta, they called it Quattro Fontane, four fountains. So
Borromini is given the task of building this church on this site at the corner of those two streets, right on this little piazzetta of Quattro Fontane. Now, in good Renaissance form, there would have been two kinds of churches. One kind of church sits on a piazza, and it's like a badass big object, and it dominates the piazza, and it faces the piazza. So that would have been true of St. Peter's. It would have been true of Santa Maria Maggiore. There are these big object buildings that they have maybe a dome or a tower or something that makes them a clear object on the piazza. And he thinks, well, there's a certain logic to that. I've got a piazzetta, not quite a piazza, but how can I ignore Quattro Fontane? I mean, that's a really important site. So I should make a building that is an object building and that addresses Quattro Fontane. That's smart. That's the logical thing, right? But no, no. On the other hand, there is this really the dominant street here. And another way you commonly did a church in Rome at the time was that you put it in a line on the street, and it had a facade that faced that street. You didn't see it as an object. You saw it as an edge. It was the edge to the street. And so there's a certain logic in saying, well, it really ought to be a church that faces the street here and that really has an address and a door that goes in off the street. And so he says, okay, well, you need really a facade here, and that facade needs to address the street, and that's how you go into the building. So instead of saying, do I choose the object building on the piazzetta or do I choose the edge building on the street, he says, I choose both because they're both real. It's complex. It's kind of contradictory, but I'm going to do both of those things. So in fact, he makes a building that both addresses the piazzetta and addresses the street, and in some ways creates a little tension and a little complexity there. This is not all resolved. This one says the world is not perfectly orderly. You know, it's complex. It's got irresolution. It's ambiguous. Live with it. Be comfortable with it. That's what life is like. So also the same kind of thing happens on the inside of the church. So again, there were two kinds of attitudes about churches in this period, about the way the inside worked. One attitude of the Catholic Church at the time was that the way you make a church is you have an aisle down the center, you have the altar at the end, there's the whole procession, all the priests march in with their flags and with their incense, and they walk down the aisle, and they arrive at the altar at the end, and all of the congregation is in rows of seats that go up to the front. Very traditional way of doing a church, and that was very prevalent at the time. But then in the Renaissance, they had another idea about how you might do a church, and that was what was called the centrally planned church. And that said that, no, 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 it's not about our process in a religious ceremony. It's about God being here. The important thing to talk about is God being here. And the way to do that is to have a dome at the top and have a lantern where the light comes in. And often there was a symbol of the Holy Spirit painted up there so that the Holy Spirit would come in and descend. And then the altar would be right under the dome and the church would be, the congregants would be around it. So that it was really about God being here under the dome. So both of those were prevalent ways of doing churches at the time. And again, Borromini's like, holy shit, I mean, how do I make this choice? Both of them make perfect sense. It's complex, it's contradictory here. So what he does, kind of really cleverly and miraculously, is that he does both. He makes something where when you come in off the street here, through that facade, you have a long nave church with the altar at the end, the aisle down the center, and a place to sit on both sides. But then once you get in the church, there also is a dome and the ability of the Holy Spirit to descend and have a center in the middle of the church. So the shape is neither the rectangle of the nave church, nor is it the circle of the centrally planned church, but it's somewhere in between. This complicated geometry that he uses to resolve the dome at the top and the long, thin building at the bottom. And all of the shapes and forms are both about the aisle that goes down the center, the benches on both sides, the altar there. But it's also about above you, this dome, that allows the Holy Spirit to come in through the light there and descend on the congregation. So a completely different way of seeing the world. Is the world orderly? We can put it all in its place. Is that the way business is run? Is that the way I organize my family? Are things always hierarchical? There is a top, there is a middle, there's a bottom. Everything is in its place. It works by rules. Or is life a little more ambiguous? Are there things that two things seem right? We can't choose between them. We have to let them coexist. A completely different way of thinking about things. So going from the Renaissance to Baroque, we have that kind of transition from very orderly to more complex, both of them highly intellectual. The same way in the modern period, we have that movement from very orderly to more complex. And the example we're looking at here is a museum in Denver. And what was happening here is that there was the existing art museum building here. The city had just built a new library there. All of this area down here is the civic center. It has city hall, it has state capitol, it has, you know, the main library, the main art museum. All of that worked perfectly on this big green area of the civic center. But then they needed to add a new piece to the museum. They would love for it to have been on the civic center, but there's no more room. There's no place for a new museum there. So they buy a piece of land behind it, but in fact, the museum building almost jumps into the civic center. It's over there, but it's jumping in a way across the street and into the civic center there. And it's very clear that this is not, you know, it's almost like everything's not right. This wasn't the right site. The right site's over there. So the building is actually going to gesture very heavily to be a part of something not where it is, but over there. And then the building itself just becomes this agglomeration of very complex geometries and forms. There is a condo building across the street from it there, and it also has that kind of, whoa, maybe that Bryn Mawr image of that's what, you know, the goal is for women being orderly, like men, analytical. This was beginning to say, oh man, maybe all that mid-20th century stuff, not exactly right. So here in 2006, we get a museum building that is just crazy, wild. It's an adventure. You don't know exactly where you're going. You can't predict what things are going to be. It's mysterious. It's alluring and compelling. It is trumping your expectations. So there's an expectation maybe, well, it should have been in the Civic Center. No, it's over there, but it's going to jump over here. The same kind of revision of expectations happens all through the building. And actually, when the building first opened, there were articles in the newspaper about people got disoriented inside it. It's almost not, I mean, there's not only not order, there's maybe your whole balance of your body feels discombobulated by this very challenging, very complex space within the building. And then as a place to display art, you see this is a mid-20th century Saul LeWitt piece, very orderly, but the contrast of that with the area around it. And in fact, in many cases, the art, not so much like I'm a building that nurtures this art. Let me show you how accommodating I can be of the art. Almost exactly the opposite. Like the building is shunning the art. You can't hang anything on the walls. The walls aren't straight. They're all crooked. So there's this challenge and fight back and complexity in the building as compared to its function. So again, it's this notion, a completely different idea. I'm not here to make life more orderly and clear. I'm here to show the ambiguities, the complexities, the difficulties. And that's what the building screams at the visitor. Okay. The ability to show order the ability to show complexity. The third issue I said I wanted to talk about is this notion of technique or technology. And again, in the Renaissance, we have this very analytical mind talking about technology. There's a guy named Alberti. He comes along in Florence in the 15th century, and he writes 10 books on architecture just like Vitruvius had. So Vitruvius did it in Roman times, he did it in the Renaissance. And in his 10 books, he writes these very eloquent essays about technology in architecture. And it really is about two completely different kinds of structural technology. One is you have walls made out of stone or brick, masonry walls. And if you want to make an opening in it, then you make an arch. And he just says that carries the load, the gravity loads around the building. The arch is the way to penetrate, to make a hole in a brick wall. Or there's a completely different way of construction, which is about columns and beams. And now we're not talking about walls at all, and the penetrations are the voids between the columns and beams. So he said those are the two ways you build. And then when he built in this church in Mantua, he kind of tries to marry the wall with the arched openings like that, with a frame of a beam and columns like that. And in the process of marrying those things together, he gets pilasters, which are sort of columns, but sort of thickened wall. So he's telling you about the technology of these two types of building and how they might be married together. The loads of that vault being carried then to beams that then are on columns that carry the load down to the ground. And we can look at this thing and say, oh, I love arches, they're beautiful. No, this is not about some beautiful, just pretty thing there. It's about telling you about technology. It's about how you gather loads together in a stone wall, you transfer them to this beam, and from that to this column that takes it down to the ground. And he actually then began to talk about this marriage between an arch becomes sort of like a bent beam. Like that could have been a flat beam sitting on these columns, but an arch becomes a bent beam. And the whole building is just completely explaining technology. These great vaults that sit on these big beams, those big beams across here that sit on these great pilasters, the whole dome sitting on these squinches that then is carried by these vaults to these beams and down these columns. And all those things we look at as ornamentation are not ornamentation at all. They're really an explication of the technology of the building. And this is true in many of what we call classical buildings, where, like the Parthenon that we looked at earlier, but where they're explaining their technology. This is how we transfer loads and carry them in the building. And so that was a very, and in the Renaissance, that was logical, that was interesting. He's discussing to me the way this building is built, its construction, its technology. Then in the 20th century, there was a similar kind of, again, interest in technology. But in this case, it's a completely different kind of technology. Now along come all kinds of new materials, like steel and glass, which now we're not building out of stone. We're building out of lightweight materials like steel and glass. And so now, and architects like Gerrit Rietveld would have looked at things like airplanes. Oh my God, look how they use that sheet metal and these thin, light, delicate ribs of things. And they make something that's lighter than air and that can freaking fly. Why would we build buildings out of these ponderous, heavy technologies? Instead, we should use this new, lighter, thinner, more delicate technology. So what you see in the Rietveld house, in the Schroeder house here, is steel columns and reinforced concrete slabs. Just the least minimum amount of material, almost made like a house of cards, like it's very, very delicate. And it uses these high strength things to do big jobs. And it goes not just for the house itself, which has all that character, but he designed all the furniture in the house as well. And you see in this chair, it's telling you the technology of how you make a chair. we've got a leg, and then we've got a support that goes across and attaches to the leg, and then the arm is held up by this other support, and all of those little joints are like tinker toys. We see the technology, how it's put together, how it's made. And it's meant to attract our head. Our head is assembling and disassembling all of these things together. And we see that really, really strong but lightweight steel being able to cantilever out there and become that handrail almost without any weight at all. But it's talking to us about early 20th century new technologies on the inside, on the outside, big openings. Now we don't need to have heavy stone walls. We can have huge sheets of glass because we have these little thin columns made out of steel. They can do the job. And the technology is explained to you, and it dictates a completely revolutionary way of making a building. So in the way that Edward Manet was giving a kind of social revolutionary attitude, Gerrit Rietveld, believe me, caused equal controversy in Utrecht in the 1920s by taking a neighborhood that was full of cute little brick buildings that everybody loved, and he says, no, that's not our technology of today. Let's talk about our technology of today. And that's steel, and that's reinforced concrete, and that's materials like glass that we didn't have before, but that now we can use and make completely different kinds of spaces. And that's what the building expresses. And then again, even later than that, in the 1970s, we see other kinds of technology beginning to be in the forefront. Okay, we can talk about structure, and we've got steel, and we've got these great cantilevers, and in this building, there was even the notion of maybe you could make it so it was flexible. And as your needs change, you could actually just ratchet that thing up and down just like you would a erector set. But you know, in the end, it didn't move, but it still had that sense of malleable, changeable technology. And in this, which is a very prominent art museum for an extension of the Louvre in the 1970s in a very prominent part of Paris, in the Centre Pompidou, is not only talking about technology of structure, but also all these other technologies we have these days. You know, those old buildings, they didn't have mechanical systems. They didn't have plumbing. They didn't have electricity. Look what we've got now. And, you know, there's the escalator. That mechanical device becomes a major kind of architectural element, talking about that technology. The air conditioning ducts, now not hidden on the inside of the building, but taken to the outside of the building, and saying, you know what our buildings are about these days? They're about technology. They're about heating and cooling and wiring and plumbing and all of those kinds of things. And why not appreciate that? That's what a building is. Huge intakes for the air conditioning system, taking it down below. Huge blue ducts that go up to big air handlers at the top. All of those things becoming architectural devices. We see the transformers, the electrical transformers, these big orange boxes that are necessary for the function of the building. Usually hidden, but now, no, out in front. Look at them. And all the wiring and the plumbing and the everything made explicit on the outside of the building. It's like taking the exoskeleton of the building and just taking the skin off and letting it all be there to see, so that it really is a kind of authentic representation intellectually of what a building is. It's meant to speak to our head. What is a building? And then it calls into question, well, what is an art museum? What is art? Is art really this stodgy old stuff that goes in stone buildings? Or is art now in the 20th century and the 21st century some ephemeral thing? It's an installation. It's meant to challenge and provoke. And why wouldn't the art museum also be something that is meant to challenge and provoke? And in fact, it was, it still is, an extremely controversial building in Paris. And it talks to a role of art and a role of technology and a role of a society dominated by an infatuation with technology in the character of the building. Now, if you look at the last building we looked at in the last lecture, the Sydney Opera House, that is form that hits your gut, that is just sensual and just beautiful. If you look at the Centre Pompidou, you know, you can see the same elements of form, the color, the texture, the shapes. All of those things are still there. But in addition, this notion of really talking to you about other kind of more intellectual, more head-oriented issues. Okay, Twitter card question for today. I want you to think of a building on the campus, on the UT campus. We walked around the UT campus the other day. Part of that was to give you a little, you know, look closer at these buildings. I want you to think of a building on the campus that expresses one of these three ideas, that expresses order, or that expresses complexity, or that expresses technology or technique. And just write me a little bit about how it does that. Find a building on the campus that expresses order, or expresses complexity, or expresses technique, and describe just briefly how it does that.